You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It is episode 186 of Below the Belt. I'm happy about this one today. We've had this one planned for a little while. Since we all went to the Rumble in the Jungle rematch show down in the Docklands, I think. Luke, where was it? Where was it? Where did we go?
Yeah, it was somewhere, Docklands. Surrey Quays or something,
yes,
was it?
Surrey Quays. We went down to that. It was me and you, Luke, and our good friend Paul Zanon, who's also with us. How are you, sir?
I'm very good, mate. Good to hear you guys on the podcast.
Yes, nice, you guys. Nice to have you guys back. I don't know if we did it last January. It might have been the January before, but we did what I coined the State of the Game podcast, where we kind of talked generally about the state of boxing. I don't know if we did that last year or the year before. I've kind of borrowed that from Ring Magazine, because they always do the State of the Game sort of stuff. But we're not going to do that comprehensively today. We're going to talk more about recent stuff that's gone on, but we'll touch a little bit upon the state of the game and how boxing is towards the end. First things first, how are we both? Luke, what have you been up to?
Just been working, man. Yeah, I'm all right. Just had a nice Christmas, good crimbo. Mm-hmm. Some of my family were over from New Zealand, who I don't see very often, so that was nice. Mm. And just toiling away at school. Had Ofsted a couple of months ago.
Oh, nice.
And smashed it, so that was good. So yeah, it's all good, man.
Excellent. And Paul, how are you?
Yeah, good, mate, good. I've got a ghosted a book about a guy called Paul Hardcastle, which will be coming out later this year. And apart from that, I've been doing a hell of a lot of prison visits. So, feel very blessed to be able to do that and connect with prisoners, basically trying to, I guess, give them positive choices in terms of what to do when they're in prison and when they come out as well, through the power of reading, but more writing, you know. So, I've been lucky to, through my networks, to have a good sort of sporting black book to an extent. So I managed to get Paul Parker in last in December. I've got Tony Gale coming in a few weeks' time and a few more planned out as well. So, if someone had told me sort of, 6 years ago, I'd be going into prisons and doing talks, I'd have told them to something off, you know. But now I love it. I did over 40 visits last year and I'm already flying through it now. We're only a couple of weeks into January. So yeah, busy, yeah, but in a great way.
I always see on your Instagram, Paul, you're at the prisons and, like you said, doing the creative writing workshops, but I have heard a rumour that you are popping over the road to the women's prisons and firing out conjugal visits left and right. Is that true, or is that just a nasty rumour that someone's making up?
Yeah. No, I mean, years ago, Mario Balotelli actually drove right through a wall, and his answer was he did it just because he wanted to see inside a prison. I thought, well, I ain't got like a, you know, big Jeep or nothing to go through a wall, so I have to sort of work out how to climb the walls instead, you know. So I'm getting there. I'm getting, you know, slowly working on it. Like, kind of like Great Escape,
yeah,
but
yeah. I just that. Like I like to just spread this rumor that you're a massive, massive Lothario, and so I just have it in my head that you're popping over the road to the women's prison and filling up your black book there.
They don't call him the Italian Sellers or nothing, do they?
No, they don't.
That's right.
No, they don't. I've perpetuated this thing of this personality of what you are, Paul, and I'm going to continue to perpetuate it and put it out there as much as I possibly can. Talking of women, it was women's boxing headlining kind of British boxing this weekend. They seem to get centre stage on Sky Sports. Natasha Jonas and Michaela Meyer for the IBF welterweight title at the Echo Arena in Liverpool. Fair to say, Luke, that this main event and the fight was tinged with some controversy, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Can I just say, smooth segue there for, you know, talking of women to move into women's boxing. I love that. I thought it was a good fight, really exciting fight, well-matched fight, but I definitely thought Michaela Meyer won it 6-4 or 7-3. Couldn't see a draw, couldn't see Jonas. A little bit of the home cooking or home crowd influence there. Feel quite sorry for Meyer as well, who had also on the wrong end of, I thought, against Baumgartner. So definite controversy, and I'd love to see a rematch. I think she really deserves a rematch, for, at least for one of those two losses that she's had. Bit of injustice.
Yeah, I don't think Baumgartner's going to give her the rematch. But yeah, I think this fight feels like it should absolutely be a rematch. Because just as much as anything, I'm not sure what else there is out there for Jonas, really. Is the McCaskill fight, maybe, if she's still got welterweight titles, I can't keep up. Paul, what did you think of the fight on Saturday? How did you have it? What did you think of the fight itself?
Yeah, well, I thought that Natasha sort of started off very well. You know, she put some lovely combinations together. It was quite evident, though, that she was lacking a little bit of zap in those punches that she might have had maybe 3 years ago. For me, one of her best performances, I think, was when she fought against Katie Taylor, and you know, there was a good argument there to say she even nicked that fight. For me, I thought she put her punches together fast, and they had a bit more sting to them. This time, they were landing, but it just wasn't making a dent in Meyer. And Michaela Meyer, she's got the jinx of fighting in the UK, because the two times she's lost has both been in the UK, and they're both split decisions. So maybe she needs a bit of neutral territory. I think she's unlucky on this one. I actually did think that Alicia Boomgarner won the first one very convincingly, and I think she would probably do it again. Let's not talk about the drugs scandal. In terms of Tasha Jonas, is she going to ignite the rematch clause? If she does, I'd probably say that she will lose it next time round. But we'll see. I mean, Michaela Meyer just needs to carry on, because she's got a world title without a doubt waiting for her again. So let's see where it leads her. It's interesting as well that, you know, she went from super feather up to welter, and she moved through to light when she fought against Lucy Wildheart. But now going up to welter, is this her natural division? I'm not sure. A 140, how would she fare against Chantel Cameron? I think Cameron would give her too much, to be honest. Despite the fact that Michaela Meyer did win the fight, it doesn't escape the fact she's still got very, very heavy feet. She moves around like a classic Mexican, to be honest. But she lacks a bit of zap as well. And she doesn't have that sort of finishing power, that tenacity maybe that someone like a Katie Taylor or a Chantel
I think that's a fair point about Maya. Even though she's kind of workmanlike, I'd describe her as, and I think in the two fights that we've seen of her on these shores, she's looked very much like that. She presses the action, she throws enough, but she doesn't do anything She doesn't stand out. She doesn't do anything to clearly win a round, although she did. She did not so much rock, but she did land some really good flush shots on Jonas. But she doesn't do it on Natasha Jonas. But actually, for particularly in the early rounds, that Jonas landed the kind of the flashier shots, the kind of the shots where she didn't have to take anything going in to land it. And Maya, I think, has a little bit of trouble with that. I suppose the issue for Maya here, Luke, is that Jonas doesn't really need to rematch her. But I think at the same time, what else is there for Jonas? What does that make sense?
Yeah, and I think she's already said that, you know, by the end of the year, she wants to be out of boxing, doesn't she? She says this is her last year in the sport. So I guess it will come down to economics. Is there more money on the table for a rematch than there is for some other opportunity? So I don't think it's going to come down to, you know, whether she feels she should ethically give her a rematch or not. It'll be pure economics that determine that, and it depends who else is out there, but maybe Maya will be the biggest money fight that there is.
And the ringside, Paul, Lauren Price, wasn't it, who's the British champion? I'm not sure she's defended it yet.
Yeah.
She was ringside. There's talk of that fight. Is that a fight you'd like to see?
I'm probably going to be a bit outspoken there, but when I watch Lauren Price fight, it doesn't really excite me that much. You know, the way she was putting her punches together in the Olympics, I thought when she goes pro, she's going to be banging people at left, right and centre. She's only actually stopped one out of her six opponents, and that was her sort of second fight in. I still think she needs a bit more experience before we start sort of moving her up to world level. Otherwise, she might get a bit exposed mentally. It might sort of fracture a bit. I know she wants to start sort of peddling up to the bigger money because, you know, she's knocking on 30 years old. But I think she needs a few more defining fights under her belt first. At the moment, to see Lauren Price in, with either one of those two, not really. It doesn't really.
No, I'd be inclined to agree. It felt, Luke, that when Lauren Price won the British title, she hasn't defended it yet. I've just checked. She hasn't defended it yet, and it was kind of coined as, you know, well, it was the first ever British title fight for in the women's division. It felt like, to me, for a belt that all three of us all really admire and really love, it felt like a bit of a marketing chip, but it didn't really mean much because the division, you know, the British welterweight division in the women's division is really light. So does it feel like perhaps, even though she is the British champion, that Price actually is really nowhere near Jonas's level yet?
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And I think gimmick is the right word. I mean, for a British title, for a European title to mean something, you need to have some strength in depth. And that is still where women's boxing, you know, is lacking. You know, really, only the world titles really mean anything, I'd say, in the women's game at the moment, given how shallow a lot of those weight classes are. So, yeah, it did come across gimmicky. It hasn't meant much. It's not caught on. I think for now we should just stick with the world titles, and thankfully a lot of which are unified, so at least there is a number one in the division, albeit divisions that are pretty slight and where talent's pretty thin on the ground for the most part.
And Paul, you know, Jonas is, you know, she unified at 154 quite easily, actually, and, you know, won a belt at welter as well. And this is before then, she obviously did well at Super Feather, but toiled a little bit, you know, got stopped, you know, lost to Katie Taylor at lightweight. Am I right in thinking, my feeling kind of is with Jonas, is that Maya kind of, we saw kind of what Jonas's level is, and actually she's been kind of, we saw the level of British, of not so much British, but world women's boxing, in the sense that Maya kind of was, you know, coming off a loss, hadn't looked great, but was still good enough to push Jonas really, really close at the weekend?
Yeah, I mean, listen, you know, when Jonas lost against Vivian Obanoff, and she was absolutely smashed out of there, everyone thought, that's it, you know, she's gonna stop fighting soon. They thought it was going to be like Nicola Adams, you know, it was going to be a very short sort of rail on the track there, but she didn't. It was a bit of a Cinderella sort of story coming through there, and she moves up the weight divisions, and you know, the best fight, like I said, I thought was against Katie Taylor. That was after she had a split decision draw against Terry Harper for World Honours as well. But to then sort of come back and start sort of, you know, unifying later on in her late 30s, I thought was brilliant. Now she's at a point where I think she's done as far as she can, gone as far as she can go. She's done as much as she can do. Age is definitely not on her side anymore. And speed is certainly was evident. She was putting her punches together a lot slower than she normally would. So if she's got good advisors now, and unless there's a stupid amount of money on the table, I think it'd be nice to see her step away and still be involved in the sport, because she's a great commentator, a lovely person. She's got so much to offer both the pro and the amateur games. So yeah, let's see. She is genuinely one of the nicest people I think I've ever interviewed, and she's got so much to offer sport in general.
So do you agree with that, Luke? Do you think maybe Jonah should consider, you know, going out on top?
Yeah, I think if there's you know, not a big opportunity on the table, she might well do. And I think, you know, she's that rare thing among boxers. She seems to be planning for retirement as well. I think she manages a couple of fighters. She's got the commentary work. So I think she'll be good when she does hang the gloves up, because she's got a bit of a sense of purpose, good head on her. As Paul says, I've interviewed her as well. You know, lovely lady, very personable, bright girl. I think she'll step away at the right time. I think she'll make the right call sometime this year.
I think we were just talking about Lauren Price a minute ago. And actually, while you guys were chatting, I was thinking to myself, Lauren Price isn't ready, but why not? Perhaps that's a good fight for Jonas to go out on, for her to have a, you know, a domestic rivalry, to have a world title fight.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
You know, because it's domestic, it would fill a good size arena up, and either Jonas goes out with a win, or, in to use the wrestling vernacular, she puts over Lauren Price on the way out. That, you know, she might lose, but then you make a new star coming out of it. So it feels like kind of a win-win. Does that make sense to you guys, Paul? Does that make sense?
Yeah. The only thing that I wonder is, like, if you look at Tasha's face at the end of that fight, it kind of told the tale. You know, her eyes were badly swollen. I mean, it would have been a lot worse the morning after. She did take a lot of big punches, like Luke was saying before. There were some massive single shots that she was eating up, and fair play to her chin. I would just hate to see her maybe get stopped by Maya if she does decide to sort of say, you know what, I'll be honourable and give her the rematch clause, because it wasn't in Maya's contract. It's only in Jonah's contract. And if she was to grant her that and then get smashed up and maybe stop, that would be really, really difficult for her to sort of look back on. If she was to retire now and say, I've retired on top, yeah, I could have had one more fight. But in the words of Andre Ward, when a lot of people said to him, did you think you could have had, you know, at least just one more fight? And his response was, couldn't I retire having not had that one more fight? And maybe that's what you need to consider more.
It's a fair point. While we're on women's boxing, every single time there's a big women's fight and it's a close decision, people get up in arms about the length of the fights, i.e. 12 frees, 10 frees, except all of that, etc. At the minute, Luke, where we're doing, you know, women's world title fights are, you know, 10 2-minute rounds, which is 20 minutes in total, whereas, you know, men's is 12 frees and that's 36 minutes in total. Obviously, you'll be aware that Amanda Serrano, the undisputed featherweight champion, has been boxing 12 frees, other than for the WBC belt, which she's had to vacate. Where do you sit right now, Luke, on the debate around the length of women's world title matches?
I'm happy with 10 twos, I've got to say. I think they provide quite a lot of action. I think it gives the rounds a fast pace to them. I think if you stretched it to 3-minute rounds, the pace and the entertainment value would drop a bit. And I think at this stage of the sport, where they're trying to build stars, build the profile, I think 10 twos are absolutely perfect for that.
Paul?
I'm the other way around, actually. I think it should be 3 minutes, because in that way, both the men and the women are fighting on the same platform. I totally agree with Luke in terms of the fact that shorter rounds will be more dynamic. I mean, by the nature, you know, by the virtue of the fact you've got 120 seconds opposed to 180, you don't have to sort of look at the fact of blowing yourself out within those 3 minutes as opposed to the two. You know, you're working the longer game. You essentially, over 10 rounds, you're fighting 20 minutes as opposed to half an hour. And I genuinely believe that, you know, the ladies are putting in the hard graft, they're putting in all the road work. I'd like to see them do
It's an interesting one, actually. There's a couple of bits for me with this debate, really. Firstly, there's a lot of debate about it, but not so much from the women themselves. And that's quite telling, to be honest. Other than Amanda Serrano, who's very vocal about it and is actually acting upon it, I'm not seeing that. You hear people say it. I remember Claressa Shields and Savannah Marshall have hinted at it. But then immediately after that fight, they both said they're quite happy to stay at 10-2s. So I don't see a massive call for it outside of fans and, you know, perhaps some writers. But I think the women need to be the ones to decide their own destiny here, not a load of suits or, you know, fans or podcasters. So I think there's that. But the other bit for me, and I was asked about this, actually. I was on the Fighting Cock, the Spurs podcast. We do a there's one behind their paywall, and I was asked about this on their podcast, and I said the WBC have always been on the side of safety. They've also always on the side of fucking drug cheats at the minute as well, but which is a complete oxymoron, right? But they love, you know, they were one of the first to go from 15 rounds to 12. It was after that Ray Mancini fight, which our good friend Luca reminded me of not too long ago. But I think about safety in boxing in general, and I think about the aesthetic, and I think about how it's going to look when, heaven forbid, a woman fighter dies in the ring on these shores or in America on a televised card. If a woman suffers a serious injury or sadly dies, I think about the aesthetics, and I think the reaction from mainstream media will be a lot more severe than it is right now for men. And I think that's why the sanctioning bodies are really tiptoeing around that. Luke, does that make sense?
Yeah, valid point, Cal. Definitely. Was making me think this conversation, actually. How many sports is it where women have reduced time or something like that? Is it just boxing and tennis are the only two that I could think of from the top of my head? But there's probably more. But, you know, they run in the marathon, they run the same distance.
Yeah.
In football, it's 90-minute matches. Yeah. So in a sense, I guess boxing and tennis are sort of outliers.
That's true. Yeah, I can't think of anything off the top of my head, really. Paul, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, again, it's like you know, the ladies are saying that they want to get sort of, you know, equal pay and all this sort of stuff. But I think the only way you're really gonna start to sort of head towards that model is if you allow them to sort of compete on certainly a similar time-based platform. I mean, if the ladies are playing three sets instead of five, then I guess they still feel that they might have a couple of sets still in the tank there, you know, if it comes out to stamina. Like I said, these ladies, I mean, crikey, Chantel Cameron's work ethic and Katie Taylor's in the gym, if you go head-to-head with absolutely anyone, I'd like to see either one of them onto Gladiators against the blokes, you know, that's how fit they are. I'd like to see the time frames level out between them. I mean, women's football, I used to be pretty harsh about it back in the day. And for one plain reason, it was substandard crap. And the reason being is that they were simply not given the support financially, training-wise, etc. And the second that the money started to get in there and the ladies started to get the support, the strategy, the technique, the correct management, Look at the level of football now with women's. It is absolutely brilliant. It really is. And it's going to get better and better and better. And it's the same with a lot of sports, you know. You can basically sort of say, hey, this is what the men are doing. That's what we're going to head towards. And then we're going to get better than that. What a great motivation. But if you're sort of pulling a minute here or two sets there and that sort of stuff, always going to feel, okay, we're doing well, but we're not competing at the same level.
I could go with eight frees, because it's 24 minutes instead of 20, but you've got 3-minute rounds and somebody might get stopped. So I could experiment and do something like that, but I get Luke's point about the 10-2s. I don't mind the shorter rounds. I've got terrible attention span anyway, so 2 minutes is about enough for me. Fucking hell, don't ask. Well, I say that considering I have to score. I score the fights on Twitter for Below the Belt, so no one's going to believe me anymore. The other thing, actually, it made me think of something else, actually. A lot of people, Luke, I don't know if you noticed, were really angry about the even rounds. Did you notice that on the timeline at all?
Yeah, particularly in America, they seemed to get very cross about it, didn't they?
They hate it, yeah.
And then there were some comments about, oh, it's such a British thing. It's almost been eliminated in the UK, as far as I can tell. It is a bit of an unusual occurrence. But, I mean, I guess that's one thing about a two-minute round. It can be harder to score or find a clear winner in a two-minute round as well. So you're probably more likely to get some 10-10s in a women's fight, I would have thought.
Yeah, the Americans did pretty much do away with it. I think the sanctioning bodies over there, I think the ABC over there, pretty much said you have to score for somebody. The only time they'll allow, you know, kind of an even round is if it's like nothing happens. But I suppose there's so much scoring categories. You don't have to just score on punches landed. You can score on defence or in generalship. You know, you can find a winner. And actually, when I do score online for Below the Belt Twitter account, I don't do even rounds just because I know that. I know that the sanctioning bodies are told to not do it. So I always try to find a winner. And it helps me concentrate. And I think what my understanding was, was it Leonard Hagler, which had a few even rounds? And I think that's what kind of, again, another one of those.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that happened quite a lot back in the 80s. And I think that's why they said, right, no more even rounds. Concentrate on the full round and score the fight. But the joke always happens that David Haye loves at least 3 even rounds whenever he's scoring a fight. Bless him. Paul, wouldn't it be so much better if they put a retired judge on the TV to score their fights?
Oof, that's a good shout. That's a good shout. Depends which one, though. If you're going to get one like Ian's on there, then that could start to turn into a bit of a comedy show. But, I mean, you know, if you had a good retired judge, yeah, I think so. Absolutely. Someone that could see through all the bullshit and that would be a bit outspoken. You almost want like a Teddy Atlas-style character on there, someone who fears no repercussion of anyone giving him crap on Twitter or social media at all, you know? So, yeah.
I don't know what he's up to these days, but I always thought Mickey Van would be good at it.
I agree. His bullshit threshold is zero.
There's also Wayne Alexander. He's a qualified judge. I just think get someone that's got... I always talk about this, Luke. Howard Letterman was on HBO for years, and I think, I don't know if you agree, Luke, but HBO was the gold standard, wasn't it? In terms of, boxing broadcasting, HBO was the gold standard. We had Jim Lampley with his passion. We had Manny Stewart. And we had Harold Letterman doing the scoring, who was a long-time judge. His daughter, Julie Letterman, ended up becoming a long-time judge as well. Anyone you could think would be good at that job?
Yeah, people with a bit of sort of neutrality to them, isn't it, that you're looking for? There's always that suspicion on the UK coverage that, you know, they're scoring people they know quite well, or their mates, or, you know, the sort of one-eyed British bias, that type of thing. So, yeah, you want someone completely removed from it.
I think British sports broadcasting has become... British boxing is very pally-pally anyway. It's very matey. But actually, British sports broadcasting... Well, I say sports. Football and Premier League football and boxing are... They always have a dog in the fight. It just feels like there's always, you know... Not a football podcast, but if it's a Man United game, there's a Man United commentator. If it's a Liverpool game, Jamie Carragher's on comms. Like they're always looking after the bigger kind of club, if you like. And then in boxing, on DAZN, they all work for Matchroom, so they all follow, you know, the Matchroom kind of. They want the Matchroom fighter to win. On Sky, even at the weekend. Not so much Dave Caldwell. He wasn't so bad on comms. And Andy Clark's brilliant. He's the best commentator in Britain, I think. But Lauren Price, And then there was Jane Copeland, I think it was, that was on comms on Saturday. They were both, it was all Tasha this, Tasha that, you know, lots of first names, over familiar, and, you know, Michaela Meyer, if she didn't get a shot from the judges, and the comms were even worse. But yeah.
Was it the Taylor Cameron fight where it was Katie that went through?
Yeah. Andy Lee.
Against Cameron.
Andy Lee, who was supposed to be, was covering the fight, said at the end, "I feel like crying." Like, he was that passionate about Katie Taylor winning the fight, despite the fact that he was supposed to be broadcasting it. He wanted to cry. Like, fucking hell. Poor Chantel Cameron didn't get a look in that night, did she, Paul?
No, not at all. And it is sad when that happens. I mean, and again, if you've got someone who can just sort of put the bias to one side, you know, give an example, someone like, you know, the late great Mills Lane, you know, former boxer, great referee, and then also judge as well. I remember sort of seeing him, and I knew he had his own little favourite stable of fighters that were out there, but when they were fighting in front of him, he never, ever gave anyone any favouritism. And I think that shows the true mark of professionalism, you know. So it's like, for example, if I'm watching, say, Italy in the World Cup, if I think they're playing shit, I'll be the first one to say they should have got hammered there, you know. It's unfortunately, yeah, some people, they do let their bias spill out onto TV, and if we can see it, it means everyone else can see it as well. It's just more a case of the likes of Andy, can he actually embrace it afterwards, or someone goes up to him and go, mate, you know, anything short of wearing the Irish flag over your shoulders from the start to the finish. You know, you couldn't, it could have been a little bit more subtle, you know?
I mean, this is why for me, and again, I mean, this is a boxing podcast, so excuse the diversion into cricket, but the greatest sports broadcaster I've ever seen, Richie Beno, the very model of neutrality. I mean, he's a former Australia captain, for God's sake, but when presenting his coverage, straight down the line, utter neutrality, no we this or no triumphant whatsoever, total professional. That's the playbook that these guys should be following, and too many don't, unfortunately.
Yeah, yeah. The other thing that annoyed me about that Katie Taylor fight was the amount of holding she did. Oh, I could not score, especially in a 2-minute round. I can't score a round for someone that holds for 90 seconds of every round. Just fuck off. Like, no. It really bothered me, that fight. There was nothing good that came. You know, fair play to Taylor. She did well-ish, but oh, it was the coverage was nauseating, and she always does well right off the judges, but the referee was awful that night, absolutely awful.
Yeah.
But talking about kind of pro British bias, we're moving on to Arta Beterbiev and Callum Smith now, and our good friend Sean Brown, he does every week for Boxing News. Every time there's a big fight, he'll go round different trainers, fighters, etc., and get picks from them for fights. And Paul, before Beterbiev Smith, the picks were very heavily in favour of Callum Smith. A lot of people thought he was going to win. Never. I was just about to ask you, did you get swept up in that beforehand?
Did I? Fuck no. With Luca Rossi as my witness, because he actually texted me a couple of days before saying, are you getting bought in by all this hype for Callum Smith? And I replied back, and I said, am I fucked? I said, he's going to get smoked around the mid rounds. And well, I'm not a betting man, but I should have put like a pound everywhere from sort of 5 to 8. But I just couldn't see it. If like the way you got to look at it is that Beterbiev was the bigger version of Canelo. And if he found problems with Canelo, it was going to be a lot worse with him. And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, it spoke volumes. Beterbiev is 39, but he's, you know, relatively fresh from that perspective. How many more fights he can continue to work through at these sort of gears, I don't know. But no, I was never, ever bought into the fact that Callum Smith was going to win this fight, ever.
No, me neither. Luke, did you get swept up in all of that, or was you as bemused as myself and Paul were?
Total bemusement, mate. I saw Sean's article you're referring to. I think it went 23-8 to Smith. I think. Oh, just thinking about it makes me laugh. I mean, Sean does an incredible job canvassing these picks and the numbers of people he gets. Absolutely amazing. But that must be you know, the worst set of predictions I've ever seen in my entire life from that crew of sort of one-eyed Brits. I mean, honestly, bemused.
Yeah.
I mean, fair play, Smith. You took his lumps, but there was only ever a very remote possibility that he was going to win that fight. And I couldn't believe how many people were giving him a sort of better than even chance of doing it.
I'd been hearing when that fight was announced, which was about last summer, it got pushed back the once because I think Better B have got an injury. Or was it Smith? I think Smith might have had an injury. I can't remember. Doesn't matter.
Better B have had some sort of jaw dental issue.
Yes, that was it. Thank you. Yeah, he had an injury. But I heard when it was first announced that, and I've been hearing this for a while, but it was from the Smith camp, that Better B was on the way out. He's had a lot of injuries, la la la. And for people that have listened to this podcast from episode one, I always think back to this. On episode one of Below the Belt, titled "And Wolf's Marigolds," we talk about Scott Quigg versus Carl Frampton. It was the preview to that fight. And before that, we recorded that podcast. The guys in the room had heard all these gym rumours about Carl Frampton, how he was fucked at the weight, basically. And the stuff about Artur Beterbiev screamed of that to me. It screamed of gym rumours. I'm told it's not gym rumours, but it screamed of gym rumours that everybody's believing. Or, yeah, that mainly. Also, I think Callum Smith is hugely overrated by British boxing. And I'm never going to be a Barry Jones and I love Barry Jones so much. The way he can talk about footwork, it's just, I could never talk about boxing in that level of detail. But I always judge fighters on who they've beat and when they've beat them. It's so important. And you have to ask yourself about Callum Smith. It's a very simple question. What's his best win? And probably the answer is a one-armed George Groves. And that says everything about Callum Smith. To get to 33 years of age and his best win is a one-armed George Groves, who retired immediately after the fight. I just don't think Callum Smith is as good as people think he is or thought he was. And the way he performed against Canelo, I think we saw his level. He pretty much did nothing and just survived in the end. And I thought he did better against Beterbiev. He had a little go. But in the end, we saw his level and he was stopped handily. Is that fair, Luke? I can hear you, so I'm going to let you go. Go on.
Yeah, I think that is fair. But I think also it's that British symptom that we often get where, you know, they're holding out for the big fight and sort of on the way up, the medium fights that would prepare them better for the big fight never happen. You know, Callum Smith probably has a higher ceiling that he could have reached had he already fought Anthony Yard or Callum Johnson or whoever else it might be before fighting Beterbiev. Instead, you know, he's given a couple of road sweepers to knock over. And then some people are surprised that he's not prepared, you know, when he goes in against one of the best fighters in the world. It's not a model, generally speaking, that is going to enable you to succeed at the very highest, you know, pound for pound level, is it?
Yeah, and that's I can hear Paul Apps just seething right now because he's been if he's got a cat, he doesn't have a cat anymore because he's kicked it across the room. But he's been going on about, you know, kind of a super six of the British light heavyweights in particular for a long time. So go on, Paul, take us away.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's a lot of people now saying Callum Smith, Anthony Yard. Yes, this is what I'm talking about. I'd like to see Callum Smith against Yard. Or how about Callum Smith versus the winner of Buatsi,
Dan Aziz
against, what's his name? That's it, Dan Aziz. I mean, that's going to be a great fight in itself. But see the winner of that against Callum Smith, fantastic. We've got Callum Johnson, who's, you know, sort of making noise at the moment as well. You've got Spider Richards, you know. Let's get those six in a tournament. You know, at the moment, they're talking about, you know, the best five from Matchroom versus the best five from Warren's stable. Well, you know, maybe they can do something similar back at a weight division. That would be fantastic. And, you know, I'm not sure what the split is amongst the fighters I've just talked about there, which stable they're in. But absolutely, it's a great domestic thing. Why don't we do it? you know, talking about Callum Smith, it just reminds me of when Howard Eastman went over to America and he fought Bernard Hopkins. At the time, Eastman was 40 wins, one loss, and everyone was basically sort of, you know, similar. They were saying, oh, he's going to beat Bernard Hopkins. And I was thinking, are you crazy? Seriously? I mean, you know, who are you talking about here? You know, and he went over there. Yeah, he gained good account of himself, but he lost heavily on every scorecard. And then obviously Bernard Hopkins loses back-to-back against Jermaine Taylor and then beats the likes of Winky Wright, Antonio Tarr before losing against Calzaghe. Then beats a 17-year younger Kenny Pavlik, you know, and then goes on to beat Roy Jones. It was just a who's who his CV. But how anyone could say that Howard Eastman was going to beat Bernard Hopkins, it's madness. On a similar parallel to how Callum Smith was going to beat the shit out of this wrecking ball of Better Be, if there is only one fight out there which could break his record, and that's Bivol.
That was my next question. That was you've nice segue there. It seems now like everything's cleared now. Dimitri Bivol beat Lyndon Arthur at the Day of Reckoning, and now this really dangerous mandatory is out of the way for Artur Beterbiev, not as dangerous as a lot of people thought it was going to be. And now kind of it seems that we're ready for an undisputed fight. Even Bob Arum before, who didn't want to make the fight because they're both from Russia and didn't like the politics of it, even he seems to be coming around to the idea now. It looks like we're going to get it next. His Excellency keeps talking about it, Luke. A, do you think it happens? And B, who do you think wins?
Oh, my word. God, I hope it happens. Who's going to win it? That is a question. I think it is a genuine 50-50. Gun to the head. I'm going to go... Oh, Bivol, controversial decision.
Ooh, a bullshit decision, maybe.
A bullshit decision.
Paul? Do you think it happens, and who wins?
I think it does happen. I think if it happens sooner rather than later, I'm going to edge it to Beterbiev. I think Bivol is the only person who can maybe outmaneuver him. Beterbiev is not indestructible, you know, and Callum Johnson caught him. He rocked him good and proper. And if anyone can work angles, well, it's Bivol. But... based on everything I've seen of Beterbiev up to this point, and like I said, if he's still as fresh as this for the next, say, 6 months, which I'm hoping that time frame is going to be when these two guys meet, I'm just going to edge it to him. But as Luke said, I mean, I don't think you can pick a wrong fighter in this. You really can. You know, it's it. Whatever case you build up for either one of them is going to be right, because both have earned their stripes, both are unbeaten, and you know, they are, without a doubt, the best at 175 on the planet.
I agree with you, Paul. I would pick Beterbiev, whatever we're calling him, to win. I think he would win. There was a lot of... Bivol got a lot of stick for not getting Lyndon Arthur out there. I just don't think he's got the pop. I just don't think he's a puncher at world level. And I think Beterbiev will just wear him down. And obviously, there was the controversy around Beterbiev's atypical result. So not a failed drugs test, an atypical result for human growth hormone, testosterone. But they did tests afterwards and they didn't find anything. So I don't know what that means. But I think for a guy like Beterbiev, he lives the life, devout Muslim, doesn't drink, doesn't smoke, doesn't party. You know, we talk about fighters living the life. That's the kind of... It's not really a surprise that a guy who lives a life like that, who's as dedicated as that, is still this good at this age. And Bernard Hopkins is a great example of that, of fighters that don't go to Dubai for a fortnight after the fight and get on the nose bag. They kind of, you know, he lives the life. He goes back to his family, he eats right, he's back in the gym. Though he's that type of guy. So it's not really a surprise he's this.
Naming any names there?
No, I couldn't tell you, but we all know it happens. To answer my own question, I'd pick Beterbiev to beat Bivol. I think he'd just wear him down like he's done so many times before. I think he'd eventually catch up with Bivol. He hits so hard, everything's fudding, arms and he's just hitting everywhere, and I think he'll eventually just catch up with him and get him out of it. And I do think it will happen. I think the money's there in Saudi now, and I think it will happen. I think Beterbiev will win. But it's a great fight. I hope we see it. Talking of Saudi and all that lovely Saudi money, which is brought fucking Frank Warren and Eddie Hearn together. I need to watch that. There's a video on the TNT Sports YouTube, which I need to watch, of those two sat down together. It's amazing. Anthony Joshua is fighting Francis Ngannou. This feels like, Paul, another safe fight for Joshua while they kind of wait out the Usyk Fury winner. I think they want the Fury fight. Is that how you review this, Paul, that it's just a safe money fight for Joshua?
Yeah, I think just safe money. You can even take the word fight out if you want, you know, just safe money. I think that Joshua stops him. I genuinely do. If you replay back the first 10 seconds of the Fury and Ngannou fight, Joshua actually gives him like a little micro wobble in the first sort of 10 seconds. And I thought to myself, he backed away. Probably not because he was scared, but because he was probably thinking, I'm here to put on a bit of a show and let Ngannou come back in there, which was obviously a mistake. But I think Joshua would be going in there to make a bit of a dramatic statement. A dramatic statement against a guy who has one professional fight behind him, and everyone's basing it on the fact that he took a Tyson Fury on who was half asleep at the time by the looks of it, you know? So it's not a fight that I was really looking forward to. You know, it was kind of like, it's Wilder, and it's Ngannou. Obviously we're all going to watch it because we want to know what two really heavy hitters do against each other. And if Joshua gets sparked out by Ngannou, then it could be time to pack the bags and just leave it, you know? But if he does smash him up early, then all of a sudden it's like, what next, you know? Is it going to be the, you know, someone says to him, right, you know, Anthony, we found a silverback, which has got some moves out in the Congo. We reckon you can take him on, mate, you know, but it's going to be £84 million. You fancy it. Maybe he goes to that, or maybe he does what we're all hoping, which is actually box boxers.
It feels like while Joshua's looked good, Luke, it feels to me like they've matched him quite well. It was kind of Franklin, then it was supposed to be Dylan White, then it became Robert Hellenius, and then they went to Otto Wallin. It feels like they've matched him kind of safe. Is it more of the same, do you think?
Yeah, and I didn't quite, he seemed to get rave reviews for the Otto Wallin performance, which I didn't really see. You know, Wallin was tailor-made for him, doesn't hit hard enough to, you know, for Joshua to fear him. It's a slow rehabilitation, I guess, for Joshua. It's another marking time fight. It's high profile. It gets people talking. The fact he's fighting regularly, I think, allows us maybe to give him a pass. For it. What did he fight three times last year? And they're aiming for this three or four this year. I think if you fight three or four times a year, you're entitled to a couple of gimmies. As long as there's something big around the corner, maybe Hergovic if Fury and Usyk have a rematch.
That makes sense. You can see Fury and Usyk having a rematch. I think it might be one of those fights. And I agree with you, actually. If someone's fighting regular, as long as there's a fight of intrigue within, you know, two in three, if not one in three, you know, is an intriguing fight, you know, if not a 50-50, a kind of a 60-40. And Francis Ngannou, I agree with Paul, it's a fucking 99-1 chance. You think Joshua's going to blitz him, and I agree with Paul, I think he's going to stop him. I do believe that Fury probably took him lightly, but also I just don't think Fury's the same fighter anymore. And I think that's perhaps why Ngannou was there. And I also think Ngannou was, with his MMA training, was able to stop Fury wrestling him. Because he has to do that in MMA. So I think he was actually prepared for what Fury does with the using the weight and wrestling and all of that. And I think that helped him. But also Fury just perhaps either overlooked him or just isn't the same guy. I think a bit of both. But on the undercard of that, Paul, which I love this fight, Zhang against Joseph Parker, that I love a bit of that. Do you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's Parker done really well. You know, he's done really, really well recently. And did everyone see the result come in? I'm not sure they did, to be honest. You know, I mean, fair play to him, because Parker had kind of been written off after he got beaten up by Joe Joyce, and now you've got the guy who beat up Joe Joyce going against Parker, and you're kind of thinking, well, if he beat up Joyce, and he's got a very similar sort of plodding style to Joyce, and he's you know, as tall as him and as strong as him, he might do a number on Parker. But we'll see. I mean, you know, Parker beat up, well, not beat up, but he certainly did a number on Wilder. Was it a case of Wilder had aged dramatically since his last fight? I'd probably say yes. I mean, you know, he's knocking on 40 years old, and there was no zap there. He didn't look in that great physical condition he had in the past, maybe. But either way, Joseph Parker, possibly one of the nicest people in boxing. I'd say so. You know, absolute gentleman. And if he can make a nice big bag of cash on this, then brilliant. So yeah, Parker, Zhang, interesting. I would probably have to say that Zhang is going to, there's a possibility he might win by stoppage, but you don't know. Styles make fights. And when Zhang lost against Filip Hrkovic, I mean, it wasn't won by traffic. Yeah, that's a damn sure, you know.
Fight, that one. You looking forward to this one, Luke?
Yeah, I think it's a cracking fight. I thought Zhang beat Hrkovic. I thought that was a bad decision. He did very well against Joyce. I think Parker shows, you know, again, what activity can do for a fighter. Wilder had a couple of rounds in a couple of years. Joseph Parker had been keeping busy, keeping sharp, and I think that was a factor, definitely in that fight. And it's good to see him, you know, trying to build on the momentum of that going in against another top 10 guy. So, yeah, that's the fight of the card, really, isn't it? The most competitive one, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And I was a bit worried. I thought Zhang was going to get left out. I thought maybe people would just kind of leave him out. Nobody wants to fight a big, tall, heavy-hitting southpaw from China. Perhaps English isn't the best, isn't his, you know, obviously isn't his first language. So I thought maybe, you know, he might struggle to get a part of this Saudi money, if you like. But it seems like he's, you know, he's getting in there, and, you know, His Excellency loves the heavyweights. And so, I'm pleased for that. But I think Parker's not gonna be, you know, as passive as Wilder was. And Zhang isn't hard to find either. So I think it's an intriguing fight. I think Zhang might win. I'd lean toward Zhang to win, but I like it as a fight. I'm actually quite intrigued by that one. Also, that's kind of been talked about now, all this Saudi money's flooded into, is the Queensbury Matrim 5-on-5. We never thought we'd see something like this, did we, Paul?
No, not at all. And you know what? You can certainly quote me from a number of the poddies I've done with you, where I've said, you know, my complete sort of dislike of the fight suddenly moving to Saudi, because it was kind of like, you know, we're going to fight at that well-known venue, Madison Square Gardens, or it's going to be the MGM in Vegas, or it's going to be the York Hall. And all of a sudden, I mean, actually, can anyone name the venue in Saudi where the last fight happened? No, there we go. And so that's my point. No one can actually sort of, you know, name it. And I'm not sure if they keep the same venues for that long as well. They're sort of, they can create these venues in literally minutes. But one thing I will sort of like, you know, eat my hat on a little bit is that what's actually the goodness that's happened from all this Saudi cash, which is that they've been creating the fights that nobody thought were going to happen. So, you know, the likes of Usyk against Fury, getting Anthony Joshua out, all these other fights which we've seen recently, it's happened because there's massive cash. Who'd have ever thought that someone would have enough cash, enough pull to be able to turn around and get Eddie Hearn and Frank Warren and say, right, get 5 of your best out there and don't worry, I'll stump up the cash to make sure it happens. If it wasn't for this Turkey guy, it would be, you know, His Excellency there. It just wouldn't be happening. So, I'm still not a big lover of the fact that it's happening in a venue which doesn't have any historical significance at all in terms of world of boxing, but if it carries on the way it is, it may well start to, because these fights are going to happen and people will then remember where
I think
it happened.
That's a fair point, actually. I've been thinking about this quite a bit. It's, I think, one thing, Luke, that we've been frustrated with for a long time is the politics with promoters and trying to make fights happen, particularly in the UK with, you know, again, we're all fans of the British title and what this could actually, I'm just thinking about what this could mean for the British title. The British title is as big as the fights that are competed for, you know, what fights take place for it, I think. And I'm not sure. I was just wondering how you kind of feel, Luke, about, you know, kind of Saudi in essence taking over British boxing. And also, what do you think this does for boxing actually over here in the UK itself?
Oh, that's a big question, Cal. I mean, I guess I'd start off by saying that I'm not ever going to use the phrase His Excellency, even in an ironic way.
Yeah, fair enough.
To refer to a representative of a quite despicable and disgusting regime. However, at the same time, only in boxing, you know, could money from such a regime, you know, bring about good. That's the fucked up world that boxing exists within. So I don't think we can get too high and mighty about it. It's good to see good fights happening. Is it ideal? No. Will it have a detrimental effect on the UK boxing? Probably, because I imagine there'll be less shows and less big fighters fighting over here. But, you know, as a country, I think we've sold, I looked it up, they reckon maybe 27 billion of arms to Saudi Arabia in the last 10 years. So we're in no position to criticise boxers who operate in a very high risk, sometimes low reward industry, you know, making the most of what they can to secure their and their family's future. So that would be my take on it.
Yeah, no, I think that's all valid stuff. I think that's kind of my concern, is that fighters now are going to rather box for the big Saudi money than box at the York Hall or even the Manchester Arena. You know, they'd rather go and box in Saudi for big Saudi money than, yeah, box over here. And I think, Paul, that's my biggest concern with it. What about you? Do you feel the same?
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, they're literally going to wherever the checks are being sort of waved around. I mean, Fury giving it the old off-fight, any man, any place, anywhere for nothing. Well, if memory serves me, he had that deal with Bob Arum for $100 million for three fights, was it? And so he obviously wanted a bit more of that. And I guarantee that whatever deal he struck in Saudi, it would have been north of that $100 million deal, you know. So, and Joshua, you know, it's one of these things. It's like I think about football, and you know, like Jordan Henderson going off to Saudi, and you've got Messi who was offered to go over there, and Ronaldo. Now Ronaldo, he loves being the centre of attention over there. He becomes even more the centre of attention, and but Messi was kind of like, well, you know what? I've got so much money in my bank already. I'm going to go to Miami. My family can walk around without any worries. I can have a beer if I want to on the street. I can hold my wife's hand in the street if I want to and not have to worry about anything. I can just basically be me. Yes, I'm going to get a shitload less money, but I'm going to have a great time hanging out with Beckham. I'm going to play football as I want, you know, my own sort of pace without any sort of stresses. And there's a lot to be said about, you know, having the integrity for yourself and being true to yourself. Yes, some of these fighters might not have made the cash, or may not make the cash that they would if they take an alternative route. So, yeah, it's one of those things. You kind of think to yourself, in one hand here, you know, I can do what I set out to do when I was a little kid, which was, you know, achieve all my goals within boxing. Or now I'm at a point in my life where I can take on fights against whoever, as long as I do it in Saudi and then retire a very rich man.
I think that's fair. I think none of us would begrudge would begrudge fighters making money. Like Luke said, it's a short and potentially very, very dangerous career, and you want them to make as much money as they possibly can. But I'd much rather they were boxing over here in the UK. It's nice that the fights are on at a reasonable hour, because with the Vegas fights, as we all love the glitz and the glamour of Vegas, you know, staying, you know, there's even a charm about setting the alarm and waking up at 4 a.m. to watch the fights. There's something about that, but it is nice to watch the fights, the big fights, at a reasonable hour, instead of, you know, waking up at 4 a.m. or staying up all night. Fuck that, I haven't done that in a long time. But yeah, so it's not perfect, but I'm going to watch the fights. Life makes hypocrites of us all, right? A couple of more bits before we wrap up. We're at the 56-minute mark. We mentioned earlier on Callum Smith and Anthony Yard. I'm going to ask for a couple of predictions, actually, from you, Luke, first of all. If those two were to fight, Callum Smith and Anthony Yard, who would you fancy? And also, who do you fancy in the Undisputed Heavyweight title fight, Fury and Usyk? Go.
Oh, I'm going to go Yard to beat Smith. Uh-huh. Think he might be a bit hungrier. And I think he probably hits a bit harder.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's a bit more athletic. Mm. Smith's a bit robotic. Mm. Fury Usyk. I'm going to go for Fury purely because then if he wins, at least I tipped him to win. And if he loses, I'll be so fucking happy that I won't mind that I tipped him to win.
You're just hedging. That is just hedging. But I'll take it. I'll take it. We got a pick. Paul?
Yeah, I'll agree with Luke on the Smith against Yard prediction. And basically based on the way that both of them fought against better BF, Yard did much better. He actually rocked better BF at one point. He was never going to win the fight, I don't think, but he certainly put up a much better performance. So I also think that Callum Smith's best days are behind him. Possibly, dare I say, at super middle. So, yeah, I'd go with Yard at that. And let's go a bit controversial. I'll say Usyk wins this by points. Unless Fury's got his head in the right place post Ngannou, and, you know, he's back to the old Fury that fought against Vladimir Klitschko, and he's lighting his feet again. Although Usyk is getting older, and he noticeably looked a little bit slower in his last couple of fights against Joshua there, but he still had the sneaky lean backs. He still had good footwork. He was still setting traps. And this is the fight of his life. And if anyone's going to rise to the occasion, he needs to rise to the occasion far more than Fury does here. Everyone is saying Fury's going to win. Everyone's saying a good big un beats a good little un. So the pressure for Usyk here is, if he loses it, everyone's going to say, well, you know, fucking, we all said he was going to lose it. You know, he's way too small. So the pressure for him to go out and give absolutely everything, leave no stone unturned, it's big on himself. And we all know that he will do 110% to sort of to give it that. Whereas I don't know what Fury's motivation, apart from sort of saying that he's going to beat a smaller man here. And that's what everyone else is saying. So I'm going to go with motivational superpower kicking in for Usyk, and he's going to win by points.
Hat trick.
What about you, Cal?
Hat trick for Anthony Yard. I just think mentality. Do you know what it is? I get really frustrated with Anthony Yard because as much as I say, you know, kind of Callum Smith, what's his best win? Anthony Yard's run is even worse. Like, he takes on actual plumbers. And then we'll get a world. And then we'll get a world title fight. Like, it's impressive how politically, like, Frank Warren navigates him to world title fights. But he's not beat, other than Lyndon Arthur, he's not beaten anyone, you know, that would qualify him to box for a world title twice, and once against, you know, the lineal and unified champion. But I just think there's mentality wise, I think he's a little bit mentally stronger than Callum Smith. I think he's a bit fresher as well. And I think Callum Smith at this point would be boxing for money. And I think Yard, I would pick Yard. I think Yard might even stop him. I'd love to see that. I think if they do the 5-on-5, that has to headline. I think Callum Smith and Anthony Yard, I think throw everything at that. Yeah. I think that would be really interesting. But I'd pick Yard. And I've done it before, and I'll say it again. I'm picking Usyk. I'm picking Usyk to win a decision. I don't think you can box in third gear like I think Fury has done for the last two years at least, and then put the genie back in the bottle and suddenly be Prime Fury again. I don't think he is Prime Fury. I don't think he's looked like Prime Fury for a long time. He looked awful last time out against Ngannou. He wasn't grossly fat. He was the same weight as Wilder 3, I think, or 2. Mm-hmm. So he wasn't grossly out of shape. I just don't think he's got it anymore. And I think, and that's a big call. And I actually think, you talk about pressure, Paul. pressure's all on Fury. He's been calling Usyk a middleweight and a little sausage. If he loses to a middleweight. So the pressure's all on him, all on him. Whereas, yeah, I fancy Usyk. I think Usyk is, again, we talk about living the life. We talk about Better Beev earlier on, living the life. That's Usyk as well. And I think Usyk's going to win. But I'm looking forward to it. And last thing before we go, we just tipped over the hour, but that's okay. Paul, one surprising thing that you think may happen this year.
Queen's Park Rangers is going to get out of relegation. That is like Hayley's Comet, honestly. It's a long time that you may see it and may not happen ever again. But on a boxing front, I think this year we might see the emergence of 3-minute rounds for women.
So, Luke, a couple of people, I asked this question of John a couple of weeks ago. I asked the listeners. A couple of people said they think Joshua's going to retire this year. Somebody said they think Fury's going to retire this year. Anything big or surprising you think might happen this year?
For me, the surprise this year is going to be that Fury will fight Joshua.
Ah. Yeah, I can see that. If Fury wins, yeah. And a Fury very much could win. You know, he may prove me wrong. I like that one. My one when I was on with John was that I thought Chris Eubank would win a world title. I'm already starting to go back on that. I'm not sure he's going to box. I think he's going to do a chase more money fights, to be honest. But I'll stick with that one for now because I can't think of another one. Anyway, chaps, thank you so much. Before we go, are you guys working on anything that you want the people to know about, Paul?
No, like I said, you know, just the Paul Hardcastle book comes out towards the end of the year. Just putting in the hard time at the moment with the guys putting in hard time at the prison. So I'll continue to do that. I'm on a bit of a crusade and to not give up on these guys, to give them a better mindset
good
when they
you,
come out.
Good for you, Luke. Anything that you're working on that you want the people to know about?
Absolutely, fuck all, Cal. I am. Enjoying a sort of semi-writing retirement right now, and it is sweet.
I might get into grassing on people, get into Crime Stoppers, just so people can go to prison and learn about creative writing. I think that I might start getting into grassing.
I'm going to go nick a car right now. Just so I can see Paul.
Yeah, exactly. You get three squares a day and a bit of writing. Lovely. Anyway, thank you so much, chaps. And I will talk to you soon. Take care.
Sports Social Podcast Network.